All right. A call to order the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee. Today is Wednesday, March 9th, 2011, and we are convened, colleagues, for the purposes of a work session on Senate Bill 293. That will happen last today. And then the order we will go in is Senate Bill 157 first, Senate Bill 633 second, and Senate Bill 177 third, and then wrapping up with 293 at the end. So that being said, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 157. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 157 provides for one member of the State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying to be a registered photogrammetrist. I practice that. The bill reduces the number of board members that must be registered professional engineers. You have been provided previously electronically the no fiscal impact and no revenue impact for this measure. So there's no fiscal revenue impact for this measure, and there are no amendments to this measure, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Boquist expressed that this might be of interest to the committee. Is there any comments you would like to make, Senator Boquist?
Are you going to have the agency come up?
Yes.
So I'll make my comments afterwards.
Okay. All right. Good. If we could have Grant Davis and Dan Lynchied. Oh, and Marie Lopez. Why don't we bring all three up?
Thank you, Chair Shields, committee members. In 2005, the legislature adopted a new licensure, and that was for photogrammetrists, and that was...
Could you identify yourself?
I'm sorry, Dan Lynch, Yamhill County Surveyor. The legislature adopted the new licensure for photogrammetrists, and things went fairly smoothly on the grandfathering of those people who had been practicing that for years and years, and we're just now getting around to actually submitting candidates for examinations because we haven't had any applicants, but now we're ready, we're prepared for that, and we believe that it would be a really good balance to have one photogrammetrist at least on the board so that we have representation from that specific profession. Now, surveyors and engineers can serve as photogrammetrists, but it's a very specialized endeavor, and we as a board right now, the way that it's formulated right now, we don't have anybody with that expertise, and to hunt around and find somebody that has that background and as well as an LS or a PE is a tough one. We have a rough time just filling our board vacancies the way it is. So that's my testimony. I would ask for your support on this, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you. Who's next?
Afternoon, Senator. My name is Grant Davis. I'm the president of the board. The only thing I would add to what Dan has already said is that in our mission statement, we basically regulate the profession. We license by examination, but then if people step outside of the bounds of what normal practice would be, we have a law enforcement committee. We really need the expertise, I believe, of photogrammetrists to have at least a single photogrammetrist on the board. We're not allowed to do that by statute now, and I think this is basically just housekeeping to allow somebody to be on the board who is a photogrammetrist. Thank you. That's all I have to say.
Senator Boquist.
Now I'll make a couple of comments, and then maybe they can comment, too. Just before they walked in my office, Mr. Chair, and asking about this bill, and of course, I am biased because some of my surveyors
which
out there.
You do, yes.
But having said that, I had just come from another meeting in which a handful of our members were talking about LIDAR and the impact of LIDAR and a whole series of issues in terms of land use planning, flood planning, FEMA, and all the money we at the state are spending on this. And, of course, then the question comes up, well, who's doing the oversight and what's the board responsible to make sure that these are qualified people making the decisions? And the answer was, well, the board that doesn't have one. And so when we came up, and if you recall, we did all of our earthquake planning, which we spent $600 million on. We're all through this. We have our flood planning and all the rest of it. And once again, we're using this new technology, but we have the board that doesn't have an expert on it that can tell us we're actually doing the right thing. Now, of course, that isn't going to help with the $600 million we already spent. But having said that, we are catching up. And maybe one of them would care to comment on LIDAR and some of the other some of the technical expertise items that a, what is this, Pat?
Photogrammetry
has to accomplish that really does have an impact on our state budget and what we're spending.
I think it's kind of funny. When we actually met with Senator Boquist, he mentioned the word LIDAR, and I had to laugh because we've had so many issues come before us about LIDAR specifically, and when that happens, we all look at each other and kind of roll our eyes because it's a very difficult thing for us to deal with because we don't have that expertise. I mean, I'm a structural engineer. I don't know anything about photogrammetry or LIDAR in particular. So, Dan, I'm sure you can say more.
Senator Shields, Senator Boquist, what happens with LIDAR is that's remote sensing, and photogrammetry encompasses that particular subcategory. And so anything to do with any remote sensing where you're reaching out and touching something with technology and returning data, that would probably fall under that. Surveyors do some remote sensing, too, when you think of these electronic distance measuring devices. But be that as it may, when they talk LIDAR, they're talking big point clouds, thousands of megabytes or gigabytes even. So this would cover that. This would give us some expertise on the board.
Okay. Good. Any other discussion? All right. Is this ready to go?
Looks good to me.
Okay. Good. Would anybody else like to testify on Senate Bill 157?
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Seeing none, thank you. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 157 and open a work session on Senate Bill 157.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 157 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 157 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Could you please call the roll, Debbie?
Senator Bonamici?
Excused.
Senator Boquist?
Aye.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. The motion passes.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I understand.
Senator Boquist will carry the bill on the floor. Thank you. All right. We will...
Because he's the only one who can say photogrammetrist.
We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 157, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 633. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 633 exempts accident-only insurance policies from payment of assessment on gross amounts of premiums. This bill before us... has been requested by the Legislative Fiscal Office to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, provided electronically previously to you a fiscal impact statement that kind of outlines the budgetary, potential budgetary implications of the bill, as well as the revenue impact statement on the measure, and I believe the folks who are signed up will also speak to those.
Mr. Chair. All right. Do we have the sign-up sheets?
Yep.
Why don't, I think I know who the proponents are. If the proponents of the bill could please come forward.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This is Ted Hughes, and with me is Scott Ashcombe. We represent Aflac. You have to say it like that if you're going to represent them. This bill was inadvertently, well, Aflac got, to put it mildly, hosed on our watch in the 2009 session. And it wasn't, I don't think it was on purpose, quite frankly, but the funding mechanism to create the Oregon Health Authority was 2116, and the Oregon Health Authority was 2009. The last week of the legislative session of 2016 was changed to add three of Aflac's products. Aflac has about 12 different supplemental policies, and they added these three and left the others out. And it was, I think it was the effort by the task force to get more money into the program, and someone must have said, now we weren't part, there was a task force for a year and a half that agreed to 2116 without this change, but the task force also agreed to this change in the last week of the session, and the conversation was that Aflac must be a health insurance company, and there's some health insurers, and we can get them in there and get more money in the pool. And by the time Scott and I, discovered that we weren't part of this task force because we're not a health insurance company, by the way. We did not meet with them for a year and a half. Only the insiders, the actual health insurance companies, like Kaiser and Blue Cross and Permanente and Providence, were part of the task force. So we had no idea this was going on because it didn't apply to us. But lo and behold, it did. And so this corrects that mistake that was made in the 2009 session, causing Aflac these assessment amounts. The money truly does have a fiscal impact. It shouldn't be there anyway to begin with. So we asked the committees to move it on to Ways and Means, which of course it has to go to. Scott, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, Scott Berry on behalf of Aflac. Just very quickly, our policies are supplemental policies, and the money from that is sent out by the supplemental policy goes straight to the family. They can use it for a car payment or groceries. It doesn't go to pay providers. The original version of the bill didn't have us in it. And so as we watched that bill go through the process, didn't have us in it all the way through until the very end, and we were added in at the end, which is, I think, was a concern of ours. We weren't part of that group, as Ted mentioned, and so didn't have the ability to take it out. I kind of feel like, Washington and California got together and passed a West Coast tax and included Oregon. We just weren't there to comment on it or to bring up our concerns. The health insurance companies did agree to the assessment, and the way I understand it, there's a potential benefit down the road for them, because as you look at these, the assessment goes to the Healthy Kids program that puts kids in that don't traditionally or currently have health care into the system. It gives them health insurance, and potentially that means they're not going to the emergency room or other places where the costs are much more expensive, and then get passed back through the hospitals to the insurance companies. Potentially, again, we see a benefit for the those traditional insurance companies, because in the end, this could reduce the cost of their health insurance by insuring the kids instead of having them go into the emergency room and then back have that cost then shifted back to the insurance companies. We don't see that benefit because, again, we're not health insurance, and so there'll be no benefit through the cost shift of those kids being insured for supplemental policies. And so that's another point I think was that was needed to be made. When it passed in 2009, health insurance definition was used instead of health benefit plan. And because there was a need for a broader group, I assume we were added at that point. Fortunately, today there is a surplus in that fund, and so removing these policies will not adversely affect any of the folks in that pool. And they will not, we won't have anybody losing health coverage because of the passage of this bill. So that's another point I think at least is positive for. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Did you have some testimony, sir? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John Mangan. I'm Regional Vice President for the American Council of Life Insurers. We're the national trade group of life insurance companies, including Aflac. And I just wanted to mention that our companies also, many of them, write accident-only insurance. We've always been excluded under the health benefit plan definition. Our products are financial protection products, such as disability income, long-term care, accidental death and dismemberment insurance, and accident insurance. So we were also taken by surprise during that 2009 session in terms of being included. We did not expect to be included in a health care bill. So we do support clarifying this. I would say that in the interim, the insurance commissioner has actually clarified that accidental death and dismemberment only policies are excluded from this assessment. And so logically, of course, an accident-only policy would also be excluded, we thought, from current definitions, but apparently that's not the case. So, again, we'd support clarification.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, gentlemen.
Can we please bring up Inga Deckard of Kaiser Permanente? Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. For the record, Inga Decker representing Kaiser Permanente. Just a little bit of history on the bill and why I'm before you today. Just wanted to place on the record, Kaiser Permanente was one of the insurers that was brought to the table to negotiate House Bill 2116 in conjunction with House Bill 2009 during the 2009 session. And it was always the intention of Kaiser to have the tax base as broad as possible, and that was consistent throughout the negotiations. And at the toward the end of the 2009 session, when when representatives for accident-only insurance policies like Aflac tried to remove themselves, Kaiser and some of the other plans that signed on to compromise around the taxes opposed it then. We opposed it in the February session of last year and continue to oppose any adjustment or any modifications to House Bill 2116 and that whole package of bills that was put together in the 2009 session. So just wanted to place that on the record for you.
Yeah. Senator George.
The problem here is that for the most part, as I understand it, these folks weren't in the room during your negotiations, and you guys have a totally different business than they do. And so, basically, I appreciate that you all were in this room and you came up with this compromise and you tried to get money from as many sources as possible, but they're almost like a unintended victim because they don't get the offsetting benefit that you guys get by getting more people covered, and they weren't in the room during negotiations, and it doesn't seem like it's applicable. So I'm trying to figure out, other than the fact that it sort of offsets some of your cost, what is the actual public policy reason that they should be inside this proposal? I mean, the public policy, not that you just want more money so it lowers your burden, but what's the public policy reason that they would be inside of this program?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, the policy was at the time and still is that I think, their policyholders could also receive a benefit. And if you look at the language in Senate Bill 633, they're exempting accident-only policies, specified disease policies, and hospital indemnity policies. And those are related to health care, and payments that are made under these policies are often in conjunction with some sort of event that has taken place that requires medical attention. And I remember when this was being discussed on the House side at the time, there was also discussion about how these policies are marketed. And if I'm remembering correctly, I mean, this was a couple years ago, but that they are also marketed sort of in conjunction with health policies. And, the legislature voted at the time, after all of that discussion, to keep them in. And so we stand by that.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Colleagues, let me tell you what I think I'd like to do with this. I did make a commitment to the proponents that we would move this along to Ways and Means. I wasn't aware that there was any controversy around this. I'd like to stick to my commitment, but I would like to have a motion to send it to Ways and Means with a neutral rather than a do pass recommendation. If you're okay with that, that's how I'd like to proceed. And if you could make a motion on that regard, Senator George. Does anybody else want to testify, by the way, on Senate Bill 633? So let's close the public hearing in a work session on Senate Bill 633. Senator George.
Mr. Chair, although I'd like to make the original motion that we thought we were going to make, that we do with a due pass recommendation, in deference to the chair, I move Senate Bill 633 to join Ways and Means?
Yes.
With no recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 633 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with neutral recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Boquist.
The chair, I concur with Senator George.
Vote your heart. Please call the roll.
Senator Bonamici.
Aye.
Senator Boquist.
Aye.
Senator George.
Aye.
Senator Monroe.
Aye.
Vice Chair George.
Aye.
Chair Shields.
Aye. Motion passes. and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 633. And I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 177. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 177 reduces the required frequency of meetings of credit union boards of directors from monthly 10 times per calendar year in provided there in separate months. Allows a credit union to appoint a chief credit officer in lieu of a credit committee. Chief credit officer is required to have approved loans or designate loan officers with authority to do so under conditions described by the chief credit officer. Permits the credit unions to make loans under certain conditions to the president or chief executive officer of a credit union or to officers who have policymaking or credit approval authority. Specifies how the credit unions may invest funds not used in loans to members. I should mention, Mr. Chair, that there have been a couple amendments that have been requested on this bill. One of those, the Dash 2 amendment, has been included in the materials that the members were provided with earlier today. The Dash 2 amendment is from some of the folks who will be testifying in a few moments. We also have received a no fiscal and no revenue impact statement for the Dash 2 amendment. You also handed out a little bit ago a sheet of paper that looks a little bit like this. This is language for a proposed Dash 4 amendment, which has been submitted to Legislative Council, but due to an unforeseen committee administrator error, has not been returned from Legislative Council at this time. So we provided the language that was submitted to Legislative Council so that the committee could consider that instead, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Patrick. So I did want to lay out a couple of issues with this bill as we're listening to the testimony for you all to think about, because we don't have the fiscal, we don't even have the option of moving this today, we don't have the amendment to consider. But in the Dash 4 amendment, the issue, and the proponents will speak to this, is Legislative Council had read this subsection 5 to infer that the Department of Consumer and Business Services needed to have, for lack of a better word, a bias towards approval of a merger between a federal and a state-chartered credit union. And so the potential amendment would be to potentially neutralize that language. And counsel for the Credit Union Association believes that that amendment will clarify that position. The other thing that I think we need to have some discussion on, and particularly those of you who have been on the have your own corporations that have your own boards of directors, is the proper electoral process for credit union members to make a decision on merger or not. Should the members have to actually be in a physical location in order to vote to approve or disapprove a merger, or is, as is happening in other instances across the country, is online voting good enough? And I think my concern is that part of the reason why it's important for board of directors to meet in person, also by phone, is that so that you can hear dissenting views that you can't do with, say, for example, email or other type of electronic communication. So it's just something I would be interested in the points of view of the committee members on as we go forward. I do have an intention of passing this bill. There's just a question of whether or not we need to improve it at all. So that being said, I want to tee that up, and Pam Levitt, Hal Scoggins, and Scott Burgess, if you could please come forward. And you'll be also surprised to know that there's nobody here from the banks to oppose the bill.
That's because we're having a conference somewhere else and don't know about it, right?
That's right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Pam Levitt with the Northwest Credit Union Association. Thanks for your time today to hear Senate Bill 177. We generally come to the Oregon Legislature every 2 years because our credit unions take a thorough review of the Oregon Credit Union Act, and changing financial industry, changing needs of our members require us to take a look at the statutes and determine what are some of the things we need to do to make changes to our act to allow our credit unions to serve of members. I have testimony packet. I do want to make note that 40% of Oregonians are members of credit unions, and we continue to serve our members as not-for-profit financial institutions. Again, the issue of taxation is important in this building, and credit unions, as not-for-profit, are income tax exempt, although we do pay all the other taxes that any other business would hold. We're owned by our members. You're a member of a credit union, one member, one vote. You do have an opportunity to vote on the board of directors, and our boards are volunteer. And we still, regardless of some, we still have membership eligibility requirements. There are many credit unions that are community charter that have geographic boundaries, but still a majority of our credit unions are occupationally based. You are part of a business or a company or an association. So that's just a quick snapshot, and that's included in my testimony. I brought our experts, a couple folks in the credit unions who have been working on this legislation, and then our attorney, of course, to go over the details of the bill. So Scott Burgess is going to start with his testimony.
All right. Thanks, Pam. Good afternoon, Chair Shields, members of the committee. My name is Scott Burgess. I'm the president and CEO of Rivermark Community Credit Union. We're based out of Beaverton, Oregon. And this past year, in 2010, I had the privilege of serving as the chair of the State Issues Committee of the Credit Union Association of Oregon. And I really view my role today as sharing with you a little bit about the process the credit unions have gone through in advance of this bill. But before I do that, I'd like to share with you a little bit about Rivermark and some of the things that we've been doing in our community. Rivermark serves approximately 60,000 members in Oregon, and as a community chartered credit union, we serve members all the way from Salem to Newburgh, Beaverton, Portland, as far east as the Dalles, and we actually have a branch in Maupin. We were founded in 1951, just celebrated our 60th birthday as Safeway Credit Union, and we operated under the Safeway name until 2004, at which point we changed our name to Rivermark and converted to a community-based credit union. As a member-owned community credit union, we're focused and committed not only to the members, but also to the communities that we serve. We're particularly proud of our involvement every year in partnering with Safeway stores to raise funds for Dornbecker Children's Hospital. This past year, we raised over $50,000 for Dornbecker, and that was $5 at a time through bagging and selling dough for cookie dough. We also have a company-wide involvement in helping to raise funds for the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, and I'll have the privilege of serving as the chair of the Oregon Southwest Washington chapter beginning later this year. As Pam alluded to, credit unions are member-owned, not-for-profit financial cooperatives that exist solely to serve our members. And this member-centric credit union philosophy is really helping not only Rivermark, but credit unions across Oregon do some extraordinary things for their communities, especially during these very difficult economic times. I just want to briefly share two quick examples of some things that Rivermark is doing in our community. I'm very proud of the partnership that we've created with New Seasons Market to provide low-cost hardship loans for their employees. Their employees work closely with the New Seasons Market Management to determine their level of hardship, and then they're referred to the credit union, to Rivermark, and we provide a low-cost hardship loan. We didn't think that that would be a high demand service initially, but it has really been very much in demand, especially during these tough economic times. And then the second example I just want to briefly share, and it has to do with the bad news that I think we all got over the last few weeks, and that's about Blue Heron Paper Mill closing in Oregon City. 175 of their employees lost their jobs on February 28th. Immediately upon hearing that news, we reached out to the employees of Blue Heron. Of the 175 folks that lost their jobs, 57 are members of Rivermark. And so we have been working, I'm very proud to say we've been working very closely with all of them to do loan modifications, loan extensions, skip payments, provide financial counseling. And it's really making a difference. And we've reached out to them also through social media, through Facebook. Surprising that they would, that would be a great way to communicate with them, but this particular employee group responded well to that. So those are just a couple examples. Credit unions across Oregon are stepping up and helping their members in some very extraordinary ways. I'm very proud to work in an industry that consistently is a champion for the consumer. And that's really just some of the background I wanted to share about the good things that Rivermark is doing in our community and the good things that credit unions are doing across Oregon. Now, as the 2010 State Issues Chair, I do want to take a few moments to discuss the process by which credit unions across Oregon have undertaken to develop the legislative concepts that have ultimately become part of this bill. Oregon State Chartered Credit Unions come together every 2 years or prior to every legislative session to review the Oregon Credit Union Act, as Pam alluded to, and we're looking for recommended updates and changes. Well, we recognize that as member-owned, not-for-profit credit unions, we need to be proactive in making sure that the Oregon Credit Union Act gives us the tools that we need to best serve our members. And credit union leaders from across the state have met several times over the course of this past year through that the State Issues Committee of the Credit Union Association to review the law and explore any issues that would help us operate more efficiently and better serve our members. And I really believe that this bill is going to, even though it doesn't seem very controversial on the surface, I think it's going to give us a lot of efficiencies in the way we operate and help us better serve our members. The bill has been reviewed and supported by credit unions across the state and also supported by our association, of course, and I believe we've reviewed this bill with DCBS, and we're not aware of any opposition to the bill. I'm going to defer to my colleagues to talk about some of the specifics, but I want to again thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today and for your consideration of this bill.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Hal Scoggins. I'm an attorney with Farley, Wada, Witt. We are the outside counsel for the Northwest Credit Union Association and also for many of the credit unions that form the association in Oregon and Washington. And I'll briefly summarize what this bill is all about. The overriding thrust of the bill really helps credit unions do some of the things that Mr. Burgess was talking about. They do seem like technical improvements, and they are technical improvements, but the whole point of these improvements is to help credit unions do what they do best, and that's to help their members. My comments today will include the bill as it would be amended by the -2 amendments, which we do ask that the committee adopt. These -2 amendments came about after further discussions with DCBS after the Legislative Council draft of the bill came out. So we've put forth the -2 amendments to deal with some of those comments from the DCBS, and we do ask that you adopt those. The first thing that the bill does is it changes the requirements for meetings of the board of directors of a credit union. The current requirement is that the board has to meet monthly, once a month, except when there is an annual meeting of the credit union's members, and all the board is there, they can skip that month. And the proposal is to change this to say that they have to meet 10 times a year in 10 separate months. And what this would allow them to do is, again, continue to maybe skip the month where they have an annual meeting, but it also would allow for rescheduling in times of inclement weather or other sort of exigencies that come up. I think the impetus for this was a couple of times in inclement weather. Some credit unions may have had their board meetings toward the end of the month, and they said, you know, if we postpone it a week and go into next month, now we're in violation of the Act because the board hasn't met this month, which is what the Act requires. And so this is to provide a little more flexibility. The board continues with its oversight requirements and gets reports from management, but this just allows them a little bit more flexibility in terms of their ability to schedule and reschedule as necessary. Second thing that the bill does is it simply changes the title of the person who is previously called the credit manager to be the chief credit officer, and that's simply to line the act up with current industry practice. Most credit unions, most banks have somebody that they call a chief credit officer, and this simply recognizes that the person that's referred to in the act as the credit manager really is a chief credit officer. Avoids confusion. Third thing that the bill does is more substantive in nature, and again, this is designed to sort of streamline and keep the board's focus on what it should be on, and that is it changes the process for approval of loans to directors, supervisory committee members, and senior management of the credit union. And the current rule is that whenever someone's loans from the credit union, someone in that group's loans from the credit union would exceed $100,000, then any loan that would cause the aggregate of their loans to go over $100,000 and all the loans after that would have to be approved by the board of directors. The practical impact of this is that it knocks out anytime someone has a mortgage loan of any sort, almost, then it's going to require the mortgage loan to be approved by the board, and then all subsequent loans, even a $2,000 Visa or anything like that, would have to be approved by the board. And that really wasn't the intent of the statute. What the change would do is to say, we're going to take first mortgage loans that are under the federal conforming limit, which is currently around $400,000. We're going to take first mortgage loans out of that process because first mortgage loans really are sort of a breed unto themselves. They're subject to a whole host of statutory and regulatory requirements, and in general, they're subject to a rigorous and specialized review process that's different from other loans anyway. So it would say, we're going to take those out of that mix and say that they don't have to be approved by the board, and they don't count toward the limit of when other types of loans would have to be approved by the board. But there would be a requirement that they are reported to the board the next meeting after they're approved, and any other loan which is not subject to approval by the board, so any loan that's under the $100,000 limit, would have to be reported to the board at the next meeting. So the board still maintains the ability to have oversight and question or investigate any loan to an insider that it thinks raises eyebrows or causes a question. But it takes some of the clutter off the board's plate and allows the board to focus on what it needs to focus on, which is running the credit union. The fourth thing that the bill does is it raises the current limits on the credit union's ability to make investments in what we call CUSOs. They're credit union service organizations. They're subsidiaries of the credit union, usually wholly owned, but sometimes owned by a consortium of credit unions. And these CUSOs do all kinds of things for credit unions and their members, from back office check processing, data processing, loan processing services, offering insurance or non-deposit investment products to credit union members. There's all kinds of things that credit union service organizations do, and credit unions are more and more collaborating on these types of services and products in order to take advantage of economies of scale and also in order to be able to spread risk. As the marketplace has changed and in some cases credit unions' sources of service from other places has diminished, they are increasingly looking to be able to work with each other and form credit union service organizations to do some of these services. And the current limit for credit unions to invest in these organizations is they can loan up to 1% of their assets in credit union service organizations, and they can invest up to another 1% of their assets in credit union service organizations. And for some credit unions, that's sufficient, but for more and more credit unions, we're seeing that the types of investments they need to make in order to be able to take advantage of these collaborative opportunities is more than these limits. And so this bill would bump those limits up to a combined 5% from the current 2%. And then the last thing that the bill does is it would change the, actually it wouldn't make a change, it would clarify the existing rules on voting for a merger. Credit unions, when a credit union merges with another credit union, first its board of directors has to approve that merger. And then the merger is submitted to the membership of the credit union for a vote by all of the credit union members. And in the old days, you know, that vote took place when people went to a meeting and stuffed a paper ballot into a ballot box. And now lots of credit unions conduct their annual meetings, not just in person, but also electronically. You know, a credit union may have 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 members. They may be spread all over a wide geographic area. And for many of those members, it might not be convenient to come to an annual meeting and vote for their board of directors. The same holds true of a meeting that is held to approve a merger with another credit union. And so what this would do, and again, we see this as a clarification of the current practice, not an actual change, this would clarify that the merger has to be approved by a majority of the members who cast votes on the merger by whatever voting methods are approved by the board. If the board chooses not to use electronic or mail ballots, it doesn't have to. But if the board chooses to use those methods, then the majority that's required is a majority of all the members voting, not a majority of members who actually attend the meeting. In our view, promotes actually greater democracy within a credit union because it maximizes the ability of the members to participate. And that's what it's all about, is making all the members' voices heard. Now, Chair Shields, I understand your issue about board members being able to have in-person meetings and have back and forth on issues so that you can you know, fully air and discuss the pros and cons of an issue before actually voting on it. And that is an important element of board meetings, and that's something that credit unions pay attention to in terms of their board meetings. When you're dealing with an issue like a merger, and especially where you have a credit union that might have 5, 10, 30, 40, 50,000 members, it's simply not going to be possible to have a meeting at where a substantial group of those members can get together and in some kind of reasonable way actually have a back and forth discourse over the pros and the cons of the merger. And in situations like that, there are usually other methods where that kind of discourse can occur. You know, there's lots of blogs. Oftentimes the credit union's own website will offer the ability for members to comment back and forth. And members don't hesitate to start their own blogs or websites. I've certainly seen that in my practice. And so I think that the ability to have that discourse among members to vote on a merger is there. It's just that in the modern age, it takes place in a different way than in a smoke-filled room with people yelling and screaming at each other. And I don't think that's a bad thing. It promotes democracy, and that's what it's all about. The final thing that the Dash 4 amendments, which haven't been actually offered yet, would do is to clarify the merger section of the statute. And it would clarify specifically the language dealing with out-of-state mergers or merger of an Oregon credit union with a state-chartered credit union that's chartered in another state or with a federally chartered credit union. And I understand there were some members who had concerns that the current language would cause the DCBS to say, you know, we really have to approve such a merger unless there's some overriding argument that would say that we can't approve it. And this change that would be in the Dash 4 amendments, which the association would certainly support, would simply say that an out-of-state merger or a merger of a federal credit union with an Oregon State Chartered Credit Union would be possible to the same extent, no more and no less, than a merger of two in-state Oregon State Chartered Credit Unions. So that, in a nutshell, is what the bill would do.
That's good. I appreciate your comments, and I think it was very important to get every section on the record, and I thought you clearly articulated the issues around it. Senator Boquist.
Well, Mr. Chair, since you raised the issue, I'm looking at the testimony from counsel, from the credit union council. Section 5 of the bill revises the wording, ORS-XXX, to make clear that credit unions may permit voting by mail and electronic ballot in additional persons. And I was still on judiciary with Senator Bonamici, and looking at the bill, it's about as clear as mud. But I'm not sure I'd say that does it. But since it's existing practice, and you guys can hire all your lawyers to fight it out, that's fine. So I guess my question really is of Mr. Burgess in the practicality here, in what we're talking about in a voting process. You'd either you either mail out, and of course it goes through the Postal Service, and so then the individual mails back, and that's pretty validatable. The second question is, I'm assuming if it's electronic, it's probably electronic and means through your existing banking system in which they have to type in their code to get up on there so you know it's them that's doing the voting, so on and so forth. Is that correct?
Chair Shields, Senator Boqvist, yes, it would certainly, there would be a lot of security features involved in the electronic voting. In all likelihood, it would, we don't currently do that at Rivermark, obviously.
Because you're merging it, right.
I'm winging it a little bit here, but a good portion of our membership has online banking, and a lot of it would be done through the online banking platforms, which would be encrypted and have passwords and all of that. So I think it would be very, very safe. Yeah.
Can I just share a follow-up? Okay, Council, bail him out here. How do the mergers really work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boqvist, and one of the credit unions that I belong to is actually in the middle of an election right now that is being conducted this way for their annual board of directors election. The way that you first get identified or verified as a credit union member is, in fact, through the online banking system, although it's not limited to that. That's the most common way. But many of the credit unions that do electronic voting actually hire an outside firm to oversee and tabulate and actually conduct and collect the voting. And so technically, I believe the way that it works is, and it doesn't have to work this way, but it certainly can, is when you go to the website and say that you want to vote electronically, then after you've gone through whatever identification procedure is required to get you in online, then you're actually transported to the website of the outside company that does the vote tabulation. And there's special corporate governance groups that handle this kind of voting that are the usual ones that provide that service.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator George.
I guess I can see both sides of this issue, because on one hand you want more people participating, on the other hand you want dissenting votes. So let me just ask you, is there a way for dissenting votes to be inserted into this program? Like, do you have a voter's pamphlet type thing that people can say, I disagree with this and this is why, so that people who are voting online can hear multiple sides? Is there any process for that?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, that process certainly could be available, and it depends on the desires of the credit union members who want to make their voices heard. There are multiple ways that they can do that. Most credit union members who want to voice a dissenting opinion, in my experience at least, most of them have determined that they can be more effective in doing that a different way than through official credit union channels. And so they will try to contact members in a different way. They might, again, start up their own website. They might write letters to the editor. But there are certainly ways to make those voices known to other credit union members if they want to do that. Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I guess what I'm trying to say is it seems like to me that you kind of kill two birds with one stone here. I think the chair's concerns kind of is an interesting point to me, because obviously my first initial view of the bill is you want as many people participate as possible, so online is great. So I support your guys' efforts. But what was brought up in the committee so far is that then it's harder for people. If you're at a big meeting, I can stand up and say, oh, this is ridiculous because of this, and I can at least have my voice officially to the people who are going to vote. And it seems like to me that it might be better if we had a system where it's online, but also people can post to a common site or a something common where people can, before they vote, can see or read different opinions on a merger or acquisition or something like that. I just kind of want to give you a helpful hint that I think the point is at least legitimate, that people need to hear both sides of every argument.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, that is an excellent point, and there are certainly credit unions who have gone through this process that have done that, have actually provided a means. And again, some of that depends on the cooperation of the members who want to cast a dissenting voice. Sometimes they really want to go out and be heard and be a part of the process. Sometimes they just want to be uncooperative, and you're not going to wind up having members like that participate in a process of getting information out to other members. members. But you can certainly create a forum. But by the same token, the credit union's board has a duty to do what it believes is in the best interest of the credit union. And so it puts forth the arguments for why it believes that a merger should happen, if indeed it believes the merger should happen. And if the board necessarily believes that when it's proposing the merger in the first place, and if it didn't believe that, it wouldn't be proposing the merger. And so to a certain extent, it's the other people who would be proposing the alternate point of view. And from my perspective, I don't think it's the board's duty to go out and solicit opposing points of view and say, we want to find some opposing points of view and put them in here. Now, they may put information about pros and cons in their own disseminations to members, but I think it's up to the members to put forth their own dissenting views, and they certainly haven't been hesitant to do that.
Senator Boquist.
What do you want to discuss, Mr. Chair? So, question for you. There's 82 state and federally chartered credit unions in Oregon, and obviously we're doing the annual two-year update. I think most of us have been here long enough. We've seen this update multiple times. There's nothing new here. But having said that, 10 years ago, how many were there, and what's the real impact? If there's 82, how many merge on a routine basis?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, and I don't know if anybody has statistics handy, but I can go off the top of my head. Certainly 10 years ago, there were more than there are now. I know 20 years ago when I started in this business, there were something like 12,000 credit unions in the country, and now there's around 8, give or take, maybe a little less. And that same sort of decline in numbers is evident in our state. I think when I started practicing, there were about just under 200 credit unions in the state of Oregon in 1991, and so that gives you evidence of how frequent this is. And it's not unusual. We have credit unions that are $1, $2, $5, $10 million, and they reach a point where maybe a CEO is retiring or something like that, and they simply cannot find somebody who can run a federally insured, federally regulated financial institution for what the old CEO is willing to work for, and they simply find that the only feasible alternative is to merge.
Well, Mr. Chair, if they're in MOP, it's going to take somebody else to help them, too. So.
And let me comment just to get some things on the record. One of the concerns that I had with First Tech, which was a very, very large merger, as a member, I asked one of the board members if there was a process for a dissenting point of view, because they sent out a ballot measure statement essentially to all of its members, and the board didn't feel comfortable doing that because they didn't feel like they had, they believed in the merger. They didn't feel like they had to provide that dissenting viewpoint. But my point was, if you're a shareholder of a corporation, if there's a shareholder resolution, you can put forward your point of view. The board put forward their point of view, and so that's what made me a little bit uneasy, is that there was kind of an unequal playing field. If one party can use the resources of the membership to get to every single voter, and the other party has to rely on, blogs, it's part of the reason why campaigns do direct mail, right, to all the voters as opposed to, websites. But I think we're not going to move this one today, and from what I, if I recall correctly from some of our discussions earlier, this is not your most critical point of the bill. I would like to maybe have some more discussion with board, with the committee members offline and see where we'd like to go for that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It might be helpful to get sort of report or summary of how that process went, either the First Tech merger or some other recent merger, to find out if we could just, not a lot of data, but just some general information about, how did people give their input? How was it received? Did a lot of people give input some way? So just some information about what's happening in the current process.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to make two quick points, and we do have a representative from First Tech who could give you just a brief summary of their merger. Couple points. One is about 10 years ago, Columbia Credit Union up north in Vancouver, their board voted to convert to a savings bank. Is that correct?
Mutual savings
bank. And there was an uprising of their membership and a very vocal opposition, and that vote was not approved, and they are still a credit union. And we've seen that certainly around the country. So I did want to confirm that, you know, House comments about credit union members feeling very passionately about their credit union and the direction is out there. We hear it every day. And also I wanted to add, as a working mom, I can't go to the credit union board meetings. I just voted online for our board of directors. My credit union's downtown Portland. I'm not going to get to the annual meeting, and I'm so appreciative to have that opportunity to vote for my board of directors for my credit union. And I think that part of our bill is to honor what is happening in democracy right now and having more people voice their opinion. Now, I certainly understand the discussion about consenting views and certainly appreciate those comments. So if it's okay with you, would you like Burke Van Vliet to come up for a couple?
Yes, sure.
I'm comfortable with the bill as I think there's probably plenty of legal precedents out there. I just think it's good to put it on the record, some of the issues we have, mm-hmm. considering if it goes awry, now they've changed it, somebody will challenge it in court.
Thank you, Senator Shields. I'm Brooke Van Vliet, Chief Administrative Officer at First Tech Federal Credit Union. I've spoken with you as well as Senator Bonamici about our merger in the past. Just to update the rest of the committee members, we filed our merger application in April of last year with the NCUA, which is our federal regulator, as well as the state DCBS. We announced our intent to merge a month prior to that in March, so we let all of our members and our employees know at that time. We had many months then of ongoing communication and dialogue both with the regulators as well as with our members to communicate what we felt were the benefits of the merger as well as what we felt the risks were and why we believed it was a good strategy for the credit union to pursue. We received regulatory approval in October, and we also, when we filed our application, we did do that after discussion with the state of Oregon about the feasibility of remaining an Oregon state chartered institution, and the DCBS felt that because of the national footprint that the new credit union would have, that we were a better fit for a federal charter. But I'd also like to state that the credit union today still has the majority of its corporate employees here in Beaverton, half of the new senior management team in Oregon, and we're committed to remaining heavily involved in the Oregon community and the credit union industry. We took the membership vote for a 30-day process, and it culminated in the special meeting in early December, where we had 100 members in attendance. So out of 160,000 total members, 100 members actually participated and attended the in-person meeting. However, we had 11,000 votes cast in total and 80% affirmative voting for the merger. So that gives you a sense of the participation that we had through the electronic and the mail ballot. And the vast majority of those 11,000 were handled online as opposed to a paper mail ballot. So we were very excited to see the mandate that we felt that our members had responded to, as well as the participation level. And to follow up on Scott and Hal's comments, we did use an independent third-party firm to conduct that election, maintained confidentiality. That group worked with our board supervisory committee as well as our internal auditor. So at no time did credit union management have access to that voting information.
Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Just by the way, curious, on the merger that didn't go through, how many members did that credit union have about?
Chair Shields, the conversion that Pam was alluding to?
Yeah, the one that failed.
Yeah. I believe they have somewhere around 50, 60, 70,000 members at this point. It was a little bit less back then.
Okay. And
guesstimate.
Yeah, and just to get on the record, if a member said, hey, I'd like to put a statement in your voter's pamphlet in opposition to the merger, what would your board policy have been?
Well, we offered ways for members to post dissenting views through a credit union blog that we promoted on our main website. We didn't feel that it was really practical to have the credit union put together a publication that presented those, but we did feel like we presented many opportunities for people to offer their opinions.
We do that in legislation.
Yeah, great. Thank you very much. All right. Do we have one more? Oh. Let's see. Who else do we have? Okay. Kevin Cole.
Yes. Good afternoon, Chair Shields, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Cole. I'm the Chief Financial Officer of MAPS Credit Union, based here in Salem. MAPS serves approximately 40,000 members here in the Willamette Valley, and we're very proud of our 75-year history of service to our community and of innovation. That's the primary focus of my comments today, is on the provision that in this legislation that increases the maximum permissible capital that we can provide to our credit union service organizations, our subsidiary companies. Like all small businesses, Oregon credit union CUSOs face the same challenges that many small businesses face today, which is access to capital. This is exacerbated by the current economic environment, and this legislation would enable us to make larger investments in our subsidiary companies. These companies are used to provide a number of innovative services to our members, services that range from basic financial services like auto and homeowners insurance to technology-based services. Like, for example, we run a text banking product built and serviced right here in Salem, Oregon, and it's offered nationally to approximately 1,700 credit unions. Those types of operations require capital to be successful, and our ability to innovate is constrained by our current access to capital in that area. The legislation increases the combined limit from the current 2% to 5%, and we believe this will be adequate to enable Oregon's credit unions to continue to grow and innovate and better serve our members. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Just to be clear, so this would one credit union would have to max out at 5% of its assets.
That's correct. Each credit union can currently make a capital investment, an equity investment equal to 1% of its assets in all of its service organizations, and can make an additional 1% of assets available in the form of a loan. The bill would make the combined limit 5%.
Okay. Seems reasonable. All right. Any further discussion from these guys? All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I would like to bring David Tapman up to just comment on DCBS's point of view on the bill and the amendments.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Pleasure to be here. My name is David Tapman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. That's part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. As you've heard referenced several times, particularly by Mr. Scoggins, we have met with the now Northwest Credit Union Association, NWCUA, several times to discuss this bill. We raised a number of questions and concerns we had early on, and those were addressed in the amendments that you've seen. We think that the amendments move the bill much closer to a place where we're satisfied with that. Our primary responsibility and duty is to ensure that credit unions, as well as other depositories, banks especially, are safe and sound, and also to ensure that depositors, or in this case members, are treated fairly and equitably. And we've looked at that bill from that perspective. We don't think that it changes the safety and soundness. We don't think members are disadvantaged by any of this that goes on, and so we have no official position on this bill. In other words, we are not raising any objections to that. I will say one thing is the hallmark of my administration within the division is, as long as we're having any talks about mergers, we will continue to have formal meetings as well. You can do it electronically, you can do it by mail, but you will also have a meeting, so there will be the forum that all of you have discussed. Now, that forum may not be attended by a majority, and that's a problem, but the forum will still continue to exist, so there will be an opportunity to have that give and take, because I do think that's an important part. I agree with what you heard from the previous witnesses. It's very challenging for the board to put forward
multiple positions that are in contrast with each other, because the board has a responsibility to promote what they think is best for the credit union. And so they would almost be having to say, we're promoting this, but we also want you to consider this. I think there has to be a way of doing that, but it may not be at the direction of the board in a formal statement from the board. So I commend the committee to continue to look at that issue.
Okay. Thank you, colleagues. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 177? Thank you, David. All right, seeing none, we've got a little more work to do to get back some amendments, and the fiscal we still need, right? And then we'll need to get the fiscal on the amendments. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 177. Thank you very much for coming to testify. Appreciate it. And we will open a work session on Senate Bill 293, and we might, I think we will definitely need to bring up some people to have some additional testimony on in clarification on what the amendments do. So why don't I hand it up to you, Patrick, first?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 293, we heard this bill originally on the 21st of February. It's the bill that modifies statutory provisions regulating the negotiation of rental agreements and disclosure of rent and fees, and modifies provisions related to retaliatory actions. Spent too much time practicing that other word. By landlords. We have, since that previous meeting, received a Dash 2 amendment. I believe we have some folks in the audience who will speak to the Dash 2 amendments, so it's also outlined in the staff measure summary. We have received a minimal fiscal impact and a no revenue impact statement for the measure as amended by the Dash 2 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So, do we have anybody officially signed up to testify?
With no work session, we have no sign-up sheet, Mr. Chair.
All right. I do would like to bring John Van Landingham forward. And was there another person that is in the audience that you worked with that can help clarify this with us?
Look to the side, right? We have a chair in between. We can sit there, so.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Van Landingham, Lane County Legal Aid in Eugene. I testified on this bill on the 21st. This is a landlord-tenant coalition bill. In other words, the coalition has been in existence since the early 1980s and has had a bill every session since then, except for 1991. We've worked this out with landlords. We have a very large group, a very active group. We meet on a monthly or more frequent basis. I think we met about 10 times for this particular bill. Approach this as a smaller bill than we've done in other sessions, because the 2009 bill had a number of complex and controversial issues, and we wanted to settle down a little bit on this session. So these were mostly smaller issues, sort of in the nature of fixes. I know the bill is long. That's because a couple of the statutes that we're amending are long. The amendments range from changing the amount of money, the value of property that's been abandoned and can be thrown away by a landlord instead of going through a commercial sale. That figure has been $500 since God knows when, the beginning of the Act in 1973. We changed that to $1,000. So to do that, we have to print all of ORS 90.425. I'd be glad to talk about any of those changes. There are landlords in the audience. Deborah represents a large landlord group from Portland. Jim Straub is here from Eugene with another statewide landlord group. We agree, and we recommend that you pass the bill. The Dash 2 amendments are comprehensive. They include the Dash 1s. They basically included a couple of issues that the coalition negotiated later in the year, calendar year 2010, and some corrections that I've made with LC. So with the Dash 2, it's good to go.
Deborah Imsey with Metro Multifamily Housing Association. Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. Yes, it was, as I might have mentioned last time, it was a far less controversial session this go-around, which was, I think, welcomed by all. And we are, the landlords are in agreement with everything that is currently in the bill and would recommend that it be passed.
Okay. Senator Monroe.
Mr. Chair, I really applaud your work. This is the way legislation is done best, when opposing sides get together, have discussions over their mutual interests, and come to an agreement, and then bring us the agreement instead of making us into like judges that have to choose one side or the other. So thank you for
thank
your
you.
Good work.
Thanks.
And I've been kind of watching this. I happen to be a landlord, have been since I was 23, and that's a while. So I have some personal experience with the issues that come to bear in tenant-landlord situations. Thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I look forward to the next session when it's a longer bill. Produce more paper in my district.
I'll be retired by then.
I am a little bit concerned if we go forward and pass this bill without at least getting on the record what the intention is of the more significant factors. Would that be
certainly, Mr. Chair. So
very time intensive for you to walk through.
No, I was just trying to save your time.
Okay.
So when I testified on February 21, I gave you a four-page handout that described in greater detail what the amendments are. So I'm not going to read that or go to that length. But there are essentially eight issues that the bill addresses that we negotiated together. The first has to do with the disclosure of fees and deposits and rent when a tenancy is created. And something that we did in 2009 didn't really work very well, so we came back and tried to make it clearer. And what that has to do with is that in some cases, landlords accept money before a tenancy is created. When a landlord charges an application fee to do a credit check, there's no tenancy yet. When a landlord requires or a tenant wants to reserve a unit, not enter a rental agreement, but say hold that unit, and I think maybe student tenancies are most common with that. So the landlord can charge a deposit for that, but you haven't entered a tenancy. And so what we have done in 2009 was say that whenever a landlord takes money, the landlord's got to give you a statement of all the charges. Those charges in those two examples can change, so we try to clean that up to not require that. The second change has to do with the concept of retaliation. A landlord can't terminate a tenancy or raise the rent if the tenant does certain protected activities. There's been some confusion about the issue of backup. The problem with your request is that I have a hard time doing this stuff briefly.
and we did hear this last time.
Well, now, I don't want you to rehash anything that you've already testified to. But
all right. So I did give you the written testimony. So if that's enough for you, I'm fine. We're fine with that.
Yeah, that's fine.
They reviewed my written testimony.
And anything really significant in the dash twos that might not have been addressed in your previous testimony?
No, my testimony contemplated the dash twos.
Okay.
So the goal of the dash twos was to get what we'd given LC correct.
Good. Just in case the Court of Appeals is listening, I want to make sure that we have some legislative intent put on the record. All right. Would you like to?
No, I have nothing further to add.
And you agree with what he said?
I absolutely.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. We're already in work session. Would anybody else like to make any comments on these? All right. Senator George.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 293.
Senator George has moved the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 293. Is there any discussion?
Other than on the record, Mr. Chair, that last meeting we actually heard the description of the dash twos.
Okay. Thank you for reminding me. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered, the dash twos are part of the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator George.
I move Senate Bill 293 as amended by the dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 293 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
I'm already carrying one bill already, Mr. Chair. This is complex. I don't understand.
Chicken.
Right.
Point well taken. Could you call the roll, please?
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Boquist?
Aye.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. Motion carries.
You have a tenant expert,
Senator Monroe or Senator Bonamici, did either of you have strong opinions about carrying this bill?
I'd be happy to carry it unless
I can, or you can give it to her.
Opportunity.
I don't care.
Who worked on it more?
Probably.
So I put the bill request in, so
we'll,
I'm honored.
It's always Suzanne. You're asking who's working the hardest.
You can feel free to speak to the bill if you like.
I need to.
All right.
A potential conflict of interest or something.
We'll put Senator Bonamici as the carrier for that bill.
Thank you.
That's all we have today, right?
Unless you want to do this.
Senator Bonamici, I would like to give you the opportunity to vote if you would like on Senate Bill 157. Senator George?
Mr. Chair, I move that the rules be suspended so Senator Bonamici could cast a vote on Senate Bill 157.
You did that quickly.
Senator George has moved that the rule be suspended so that Senator Bonamici can vote on Senate Bill 157. Is there any discussion or objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Bonamici,
vote aye.
Vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonamici votes aye. We'll close that work session on Senate Bill 157. And colleagues, we are adjourned.
Hey, we did that one quick.